Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. We're starting the programme in Gaza. Well, to be absolutely precise about it, we're starting talking about Gaza, but from Washington, D.C. Because today was the day that the Biden administration had set as the deadline for Israel to improve the desperate humanitarian situation inside the war-ravaged Palestinian territory. The clear threat was that failure would mean the US curbing military aid. Well, today the State Department has pronounced that it is not going to change those levels of military assistance for the time being, but that more steps still need to be taken. So what is the picture right now in Gaza? Is there any sign of the situation improving? In a moment, we'll hear from the Israeli military agency overseeing aid deliveries. First, here's our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison.
Stretched out in front of five-year-old Nizar in a makeshift morgue in central Gaza are white plastic body bags. The small boy leans down and peeps into one of them. He needs to see with his own eyes, which are filled with tears. In the bag is his auntie. His uncle, their children, and Nizar's sister, Khaloud, were also killed when Israel attacked a school housing displaced families. Israel's military says it was targeting Hamas. God is all we need, cries Barah, Nizar's brother. Much of Gaza is now unlivable. A month ago, America once again demanded Israel take steps to reduce the number of civilian casualties. The United Nations says more than 1,000 people have been killed in the last 30 days. The majority, it says, were civilians. There is food in Gaza. This is a bakery. Hot, puffed-up pitas roll out of the oven on a conveyor belt. Outside, hundreds of people desperately scramble to get their hands on the bread. Among them, grandmother Aida Al-Haran, who's also been picking up soup.
If it were not for the soup kitchen, we would have starved to death. Every day it's the same struggle. I go back and forth to the soup kitchen.
What food there is not enough. We've come now to Zakim, a military base right on the edge of Gaza. The Gaza Strip is really just only a few metres away behind a 10-metre-high fence covered with barbed wire. And there's a gate where these trucks that are queued up in front of me carrying food aid are going to cross into Gaza. Israel has allowed more crossings to open, especially into northern Gaza. But America demanded that by now Israel should be allowing a minimum of 350 aid trucks into the territory every day. The United Nations says that over the past month, the daily average has been only just over 40 trucks.
We need safe facilitation of aid into the Gaza Strip, and we are not receiving...
Israel does not allow international journalists free access to Gaza, but in a video call, I spoke to Louise Wateridge from UNRWA, the main UN aid agency there.
There is not enough aid here. There is not enough supplies. People are starving in areas. People are very hungry. They are fighting over bags of flour. There is just not enough supplies.
For more than a year, Israel has crossed most of America's red lines. Much of this was done using US weapons. But in the dying days of the Biden presidency, and with more than 43,000 Palestinian lives lost, it's unlikely the White House will put its foot down and cut off arms supplies.
John Donison reporting from Jerusalem. As I mentioned, the branch of the Israeli military responsible for coordinating aid deliveries into Gaza is called COGAT. Its international spokesman is Shimon Friedman. The UN says the situation in Gaza remains utterly awful, in large part because of the dearth of supplies. What's COGAT's response?
Obviously, the situation in Gaza is very difficult, and I'm not here to say that the situation is amazing. It's not. Israel has worked since the beginning of the war, and COGAT specifically has worked, to facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid, to increase the access to medical care, to bring in food, water, medical supplies, and shelter equipment. And we've worked together with the international organizations to facilitate the entry of this aid.
That doesn't really tally with reality, though, does it? Because, I mean, before the war started, 500 trucks were going in per day. The US has said a minimum of 350 is needed right now. It's a matter of a few dozen at most that are going in. So, I mean, it's all very well to say that you're sort of facilitating and you're doing all that you can, but you've got senior UN officials saying that it is not a place for humans to survive. It seems as if the way you are seeing what's happening in Gaza and what the reality is two different things.
First, I just want to address this number of 500 trucks that you mentioned from before the war. The 500 trucks coming in before the war were not humanitarian aid. They included food, but they included other things as well, goods, commodities, lots of different things that were coming into the Gaza Strip. That's not what we're talking about right now. We're talking about four main categories: food, water, medical supplies, and shelter equipment.
Which the US now, still says you need 350 trucks a day, and you're nowhere near that.
And also the numbers that you mentioned in terms of dozens are incorrect. And we released those numbers and you can find those on our website as well. It's close to around 50 trucks in northern Gaza a day and between 100 and 150 trucks in southern Gaza. Those numbers, we're working to increase them. The issue right now, the main obstacle in getting much larger numbers of aid into the Gaza Strip are with the international organizations. Because if we were to bring in additional, those would just be, not that there's room right now on the Gazan side of Kerem Shalom, because there are so many trucks waiting there.
Kerem Shalom is just one of the many crossing points there could be into Gaza. That is part of the problem, is that you have decided that you are going to only allow very limited access points. And you have also decided that inside Gaza, absolutely, it is a war, but it is a war zone in which the Israelis are not doing all that they could in order to facilitate the humanitarian organizations to get to these places.
You're right, Kerem Shalom is only one crossing. There are five crossings right now. There is Kerem Shalom, there is Kisufim, which opened today, crossing 96, Erez West and Erez East. These crossings are operational and we are facilitating the entry of humanitarian aid through all of them. So the reason I keep bringing up Kerem Shalom is because that is the crossing that has the largest capacity. But we are absolutely using the other crossings as well. And we've gone to great lengths in order to increase our capacity there. But I want to touch on what you mentioned in terms of us helping the international organizations do their work. And I think it's very important to note that we absolutely are trying to do everything we can to help them increase their capacity as well.
The Gaza director for the UN humanitarian agency, OCHA, says that the way in which you are working at the moment is, and I quote, part of a targeted campaign against the United Nations logistics system. You have extensive reporting of the fact that, contrary to what you're saying, there aren't regular opening hours for these crossings. There are ongoing military operations. The Israeli army is often blockading, stopping convoys from traveling. You've got this prohibition on closed trucks, which also encourages the lack of security, the looting that we've seen happen. It is not particularly surprising, it seems, that respected aid organizations are saying unanimously that what is happening in Gaza, and in particular in northern Gaza right now, is basically pretty much famine. The picture that you are painting is so diametrically opposite to that, it does stretch credulity, doesn't it?
As far as I know, no one is actually saying there's famine. People continue warning that there might be famine. And we've seen that warning exists for a very long time and it hasn't come to fruition because we are continuing to increase our humanitarian efforts and we're continuing to increase our capacity to facilitate larger amounts of aid into the Gaza Strip. So while we've heard that many times and for a long time, it hasn't come to fruition and because we are continuing our humanitarian efforts.
Can I just pick you up on one thing that you just said there, which is this sort of increase in aid going in. I did an interview towards the end of last month with an Israeli minister, Amichai Chikli, and he said to me, and I quote, "We created a blockade in areas of northern Gaza and we prevented supplies to enter the blockaded region. The policy of the State of Israel hasn't changed on this." So I don't know how you can say that you are working to increase the amount of aid that's going in.
I can't speak to what was said to you by a minister, but what I can tell you is the facts. Last week, a convoy of aid made its way into Jabalia, providing humanitarian aid. Jabalia in northern Gaza, where there is an active combat against Hamas stronghold and Hamas infrastructure. Yesterday, In the same area, in Beit Hanun, a humanitarian convoy made its way. So aid is making its way into northern Gaza, and we are making sure that we are able to facilitate aid to there as well.
Shimon Friedman, spokesman for COGAT, that branch of the Israeli military responsible for coordinating aid. Let's head back to Washington then. The US State Department saying that Israel has not broken American law by restricting aid deliveries to Gaza. Tom Bateman is our State Department correspondent. He was at the press briefing at which all that was explained. What was the reasoning?
Well, they have said that when they've looked back over this 30-day period, that they think Israel has taken a number of steps to address their demands. Although when you sort of drill into what the actual steps are, they frankly don't go any way to meet what the Americans were actually demanding. And I've just come from that press briefing where I, among other journalists, pushed the spokesman quite hard on this particular point. And, you know, he was asked repeatedly, well, what's the point of making these demands, giving the Israelis 30 days to meet them, if you then at the end of the period say, well, they haven't really met them, but at least they're trying, which was the sort of the sentiment, really, of what came across. And they didn't really have an answer to that. And I think the point about this is that this is what we found throughout the course of this, that one person sets the policy in this area, and it is the President of the United States. And then the entire system downwards has to follow through. And you do just get the sense that the spokespeople and the officials are sort of having to toe the line, despite the fact that there is, as you've been hearing, overwhelming evidence that the Israelis simply have not met what the Americans were demanding 30 days ago.
Right. I mean, it's intriguing. And maybe we just don't know the answer to this because it's difficult to ascribe motives. But you wonder what Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin were up to then, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, when they set this hard deadline.
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember is the letter wasn't, it was written as a private letter, actually. It's the second time they've done this. They did something similar in April. This letter leaked, probably from the Israeli side. Remember, there's quite a lot of displeasure within the system at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So it's not surprising that things have become a bit leaky that might be intended to do damage to the coalition there and the leadership. But we don't know exactly where it came from. But so I think there's a sense in which, you know, once the letter had come out, the Americans obviously had to stick to its demands publicly. But they never really meant this to become part of a sort of public process and a process that was being interrogated and held to account publicly. They have done things like that, actually, with some legal mechanisms during the course of this conflict, where they had to report to Congress. And actually, they took a bit of a tougher line in that. But on this one, I think they've made the decision they're just going to hold the line and say this publicly. And remember now, this is the end of the Biden administration. Their political capital, yeah, and ability to leverage Israel is draining away.
And that was Tom Bateman, State Department correspondent, speaking to me from Washington. Coming up on the programme, the female magician who tricked her way 30 years ago into Britain's then all-male magic circle club. She since disappeared.
Not only did she get away with it by convincing these men that she was indeed male, she also was very good because she passed. And this wasn't just something they came up with on a whim. It was about an 18-month orchestrated deception.
More on that in about 20 or 25 minutes. It's a terrific story, so do listen if you can. Main headline this hour, the US State Department says that Israel has not broken American law by restricting aid deliveries to Gaza. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. The spiritual leader of the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has resigned. Pressure on the Archbishop had been building after a report concluded that the Church of England had covered up decades of child sexual abuse. John Smythe, the lawyer who ran Christian summer camps, carried out attacks on boys and young men up until his death in 2018. Mr. Welby had been told about the abuse 5 years ago. The Anglican Church is the third largest Christian denomination in the world, with more than 80 million members. Francis Martin is a reporter with the Church Times, an independent magazine covering Anglicanism even, forgive me. This was, for Smythe, a very, very extensive period of abuse.
It was indeed. And as you said in that introduction, it went on for a long period of time, up to about 40 years. It was a vicious campaign of abuse, of grooming, followed by beating. It took place in the Church of England, but it also took place in Zimbabwe and we believe South Africa potentially as well.
And in terms of the scandal around Justin Welby, I mean, the pressure on him to resign, he was told back in 2013 about concerns over Smythe, from what I understand. But Smythe carried on offending for the years that then followed that. And that presumably has compounded people's anguish over this whole affair.
It has certainly contributed to the reaction. Justin Welby was told about the abuse in 2013. He was also, though, assured that the police had been informed, that relevant bodies had been informed, the church in South Africa where John Smythe was operating at the time, had been informed. So this wasn't a case entirely about Justin Welby, really. I mean, the story has become Justin Welby, but really it's a broader story, I think, about safeguarding in the Church of England, perhaps safeguarding in the Anglican Communion worldwide, as well as this focal point today, which was, of course, on the Archbishop of Canterbury's resignation.
And that's something I'm going to be picking up with our next interviewee. But just before we go to him, just tell me what the process now is in terms of the selection of a new Archbishop of Canterbury.
Well, we're in fairly uncharted waters. Obviously, Archbishops of Canterbury change every 10 years or so. So there is a process to be gone through. We've never, though, had this situation where an archbishop has resigned without warning, without a plan in place for a successor to come in. So it's a little bit unclear exactly what the time frame will be for appointing a successor. It's certainly going to take months. It's worth noting that Archbishop Justin Welby is still this night in post. He hasn't constitutionally relinquished the role of the office of Archbishop of Canterbury. So there's a question that's going to arise as to what extent he fulfills that role in the coming weeks.
Francis Martin, a reporter with the Church Times. Well, Reverend Dr. Ian Paul is a member of the Archbishop's Council. It coordinates the Church's work and he's also a member of the Church's General Synod. He's one of the three Synod members to initiate a petition calling for Justin Welby to resign. Given that, is he satisfied with today's news?
No, I'm not satisfied and I'm not happy at all. This is a very sad, a tragic episode in the life of the Church. It's a deeply sad for Justin, for him to have ended his ministry in this way. I think it was completely avoidable. It's a deep tragedy for the victims. And one of the things that, as I've been doing interviews, again, I've been deeply moved by is survivors, particularly Mark Stibbe, who've had to trawl through this again in order to ensure that action happens. One thing that I really need to correct from what Francis said, and I think many of your listeners will be under a misapprehension. This is not about abuse in the Church of England. None of this abuse happened in the Church of England. The connection of Smythe with the Church of England was he was licensed as a lay reader in the Church of England, but his abuse was connected with one very small group within one camp, the Ewan camp. It wasn't a question of abuse in the Church of England. The abuse happened mostly in his home, in his garden, in his shed. The issue is about how senior leadership of the Church, including Justin, but as Francis said, other people, dealt with allegations. And one of the reasons why this is a tragedy is for people who don't know the Church of England on the ground, this is the headline they see. This is what they think about the Church of England. And for many ordinary clergy, for many ordinary members of church of congregations in the Church of England, part of the tragedy is that they've been working incredibly hard over the last 10 years. The culture of safeguarding in the Church of England has really transformed. You come to our church, the first thing you'll see is the safeguarding officer is.
Yeah, but it's so often, forgive me for interrupting, it is so often the case with institutions that, yes, of course, there will be good people who work for it in all sorts of ways, but but somehow the leadership, and yes. You're right, it's not just Justin Welby. I mean, there are serious questions still being asked, aren't there, about the sort of the network of silence that there was among other very senior members of the Church of England.
Yes, it is, but it is this very large disconnect between the life and the vigour and the amazing things done and the work on safeguarding that's being done on the ground in dioceses and in local churches. And the contrast that Macon draws between that and these serious failures amongst senior leadership. And
Macon being the name of the man who...
Keith Macon was the one who wrote the report. Indeed. Published last week. It's been called the Macon Report.
Indeed. So, given that you have been, you know, so involved in the running of the Church of England for so long, where do you think that institutional failure comes from?
I think there are two major issues here. One is that the Church of England itself is very complex in terms of its governance. So again, something that not many people realise is that there is no such thing as the Church of England in the sense that every diocese is an independent legal entity, every diocesan board of finance. And so there's a duplication of processes and there's duplication of resources as well. And one of the big questions we're facing, particularly with financial pressures, is whether the church can continue to live in that fragmented way. And what it means with issues around safeguarding is that it means that changes in regulations and scrutiny have to be replicated in 42 different places. I think the other thing culturally I would observe is that one of the things we've suffered from is a sense of loss of contact between episcopal governance and what's happening on the ground. That's not true everywhere. You know, I'm in regular contact with my own bishop and you know, we're very encouraged in this diocese. But there is a real sense of disconnect. And I think in the last few years, you know, during Justin's tenure, he's raised some important issues, but on every single one of them, he seems to have raised it in a way which has become divisive and generated conflict. And it's very hard to make good progress in an institution when there's a sense in which the institution is at conflict with itself on so many different fronts, not just on safeguarding, also on race, also on sexuality, also on the question of the political disconnect. One of the things that many people have said is that, you know, that the bishops as a whole are generally out of touch and out of step with what many ordinary Anglicans are doing and believing and what their outlook on life. So I think there are some pretty big issues around culture. But on safeguarding, there's no doubt that, and this is something that as an Archbishop's Council, we have been desperate to make progress on, which is that we must set up independent scrutiny of safeguarding, because that ensures them, not independent operation of safeguarding, we need to ensure that we're still responsible for that. We must have independent scrutiny so that we're not marking our own homework and we are demonstrating genuine accountability and transparency. That's what's been missing that Macon has identified amongst the senior leadership of the church.
And that was Reverend Ian Paul, member of the Archbishop's Council, on Justin Welby's resignation. There is much more about this on our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. In a moment, we'll be hearing the latest from this year's COP29 climate conference. As of yesterday, we now know 2024 is on track to be the world's warmest year on record, and an increase in the number and severity of extreme weather events is having an impact on the production of food and drink. Daniel Rosny has been taking a look at how it's affecting the wine sector.
When you think about wine-producing countries, the UK may not spring to mind. But figures from industry association Wine GB show that there are now more than 1,000 vineyards, which produced more than 21 million bottles last year. That was up almost 80% from the year before. But that growth isn't guaranteed to continue.
It's not been a great year.
Nick Wayman owns Albury Vineyard in Surrey, England.
We've had a pretty poor summer. Lots and lots of rain, which has caused some disease on the vineyard.
The harvest was later than other years for Nick and his team, and there's no guarantee the grapes are good enough to be used for wine.
We've had as much as 38 tonnes in 2018. And as little as 3 tonnes in 2021, when we were completely overtaken with downy mildew. I think the general sort of view is that we're going to get more good years going forward, but we're going to get more bad years as well.
With extreme weather as a result of climate change becoming more unpredictable, it's getting harder for businesses to weather the storm. Now the industry is coming together globally to learn how to adapt. Catherine Le Parmentier is Managing Director of Great Wine Capitals.
In Bordeaux in particular, it's been a tough year. We've had frozen in May, which is terrible because all the flowers are already out. So when it freezes, it's really bad. Then we had hail episodes early summer. So this is when the grapes now are out.
But there's a growing need in the wine sector for preventative measures rather than a post-mortem. That's where global consultancy Vinescapes says it can help. Its founder is Alistair Nesbitt.
About 50% of the work is people or producers who've already got vineyards or wine production enterprises, but who are really struggling with the impact of climate change. And we go in and we help to try and build resilience into their businesses. Everything we do is driven really by sort of science, and for some businesses, it's much longer term. The change is happening so quick in terms of climate. Brands are having to adapt and they're having to become flexible.
But while the industry is looking for solutions, critics in traditional wine growing parts of the world argue that red tape is preventing producers from making changes. Here's Armando Corsi, an associate professor of wine business in Adelaide.
We have been planting lately a lot more of, for example, Italian grape varieties. Because of their adaptability to the Australian climate, unlike Europe, where if you are linked with a specific protected designation of origin, a specific code of production, there is no way that you can plant whatever you want.
A report in the Nature Reviews Earth and Environment Journal suggests around 70% of wine regions could be lost if the planet warms to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So projections that temperatures will hit a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in 2024 could be hard for winemakers to swallow.
And that was Daniel Rosny reporting. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. There is a rhythm to the annual UN climate talks, and we're seeing it at this year's COP29 summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Announcements build as far-reaching attempts to deal with the climate crisis, and at the same time, declarations that we're all failing and falling woefully short. We'll get into some of that in a moment. There has been another dissonance today. Listen firstly to what the summit host, the Azerbaijani president Ilham Aliyev, had to say about his country's well of oil and gas deposits.
I said it several months ago, that this is a gift of the God, and I want to repeat it today here. It's a gift of the God. Every natural resource, oil, gas, wind, sun, gold, silver, copper, all that are natural resources.
Which comment the UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, listened to. He then strode up to the same podium and said,
"Almost everywhere, solar and wind are the cheapest source of new electricity. So doubling down on fossil fuels is absurd. The clean energy revolution is here. No group, no business, and no government can stop it."
Two voices from the many speeches heard today, including some heart-rending pleas from leaders of smaller or more vulnerable countries for more concerted action to be taken. One other standout speech was from the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who announced a new target to reduce UK greenhouse gas emissions by at least 81% on 1990 levels by 2035. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath is in Baku. What was the reaction at the summit to that promise?
In fairness to the UK, I think it's gone down very well here because I think, you know, it's a very tough target. And the UK has done very well to cut emissions by about 42% since 1990. This is a big step up and will require essentially the entire UK electricity system to be powered by greener sources. So it's a really difficult challenge for anybody. And I think, you know, Sir Keir was aided in some respects by the fact that there weren't very many other major leaders of major countries here, with no disrespect to anybody. But the major emitters, China, India, the United States, their leaders weren't here. So Sir Keir had a clear field. And I think bringing a plan that is ambitious and in line with the science to keep temperatures under 1.5 went down well, even if people say the UK could and perhaps should do better.
Curbing emissions is one thing. As you were telling us just yesterday, financing the move towards climate adaptation, climate mitigation, especially for poorer countries, is another. Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, issued a pretty strong warning today.
Yeah, she had some fairly eye-watering figures in her statement talking about the fact that the cost of coping with climate change was essentially 50% higher than the previous highest estimates, and that if the world really wanted to keep that 1.5 degree threshold in sight, not to get the world too warm, by 2035 we'd be needing to be spending $11 trillion a year, or about 10% of global GDP, which again is an almost inconceivable figure, and much, much higher than what's been talked about here, where people are starting to talk about a figure of around $1 trillion in all total by 2030. And what she's talking about here is a significant elevation on that.
And lots of ideas going around about how all this could be financed. I saw that you were writing about people musing about a windfall tax on fossil fuel companies, perhaps, but also this idea of this carbon market. Again, you were talking about yesterday. I mean, just very briefly, you know, how is it expected to work and how is it being received?
Yeah, the carbon market idea, which has been running for a number of years now, is essentially putting a framework in place to allow richer countries to get rid of their carbon by cutting carbon in poorer countries, rather than spending on expensive electrification in the UK or Europe. They would invest in wind farms in Africa or forests in South America or some examples like that. And so the carbon credits that would be saved on those projects would benefit the richer countries, and they would pay those developing countries for that. Now, supporters believe this is a really good idea, and there's a massive market waiting to take part in this, and I think that's probably true. But there are some significant reservations about this. There's been a lot of pushback today from various environmentalists who've looked at this text and say, look, these guys have rushed this through. There's no real safeguards here. There's a lot of concerns about fraud and double counting of emissions. And it's essentially, in their view, a bit of a mess. I think the general view from all the countries who've been involved here and their negotiators is, look, we spend nearly 10 years on this. Even if it's messy, it's better to get this thing going now, and it might do more good than harm. And that's the view, I think, that's been accepted by most countries here.
Matt McGrath at the COP29 summit in Baku. And as we heard from Matt, there was, broadly speaking, a welcome at the summit for that new promise by the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to increase the UK's target for a cut in carbon emissions to at least 81% compared with 1990 levels, and to do that by 2035. Katharina Brandmeier is at the Grantham Institute of Climate Change and the Environment, based at Imperial College London. It is then an ambitious plan by the United Kingdom. Is it clear how the country will get there?
The UK today set out a very ambitious target informed by the Climate Change Committee, which is independent advisor for the UK. That target now needs to be backed by policies to deliver it. The UK has currently some policies in place, and we've seen some ambitious steps from the current government since they've been in power this summer on accelerating particularly clean energy deployment. But there are some other sectors where the UK should be putting forward a much more ambitious set of policies and investment to make sure that clean technologies are rapidly scaled up across the whole of the economy.
And where in particular are you thinking of?
If we think, for example, that the two largest emitting sectors at the moment are transport and buildings, those are sectors where we need to see a significant increase in ambition from government, for example, to ensure that buildings are better insulated. Those measures will also enable households, for example, to reduce energy waste and reduce their bills. But we also need to see measures, for example, to accelerate not only the switch to electric vehicles, but also an expansion of, for example, public transport, or making neighborhoods have the infrastructure for people to actually be able to walk and cycle around. And again, those are measures that not only will help deliver our climate commitments, but are also very important measures to deliver, for example, improve air quality. And we know that will therefore have also therefore beneficial health impacts and wider economic benefits for the UK.
Yeah. Do you think that sort of reluctance to spell those sorts of things out, are they down to, I mean, to put it crudely, money? Or is it also because the government is wary of sort of trying to do government by diktat, telling people how they should live their lives?
These are measures that will require a combination of investment and policy. And I think the expectation for this government really is that if they want to be seen as a serious climate leader on the international stage, they will need to put in place those policies. The way that they design them will be crucial to ensure public support. And I think in that respect, they need to make sure that policies are designed in a way that they enable those most vulnerable in society to transition and to benefit from these clean technologies. And they should also do it in a way that engages the public and communicates what are the rationales for these measures being introduced and what are the benefits that can be realized. And those are benefits, as I said, that are both in benefits to people's health, but they also will ensure that, for example, households are shielded from high volatile fossil fuels that we are currently exposed to. And they will also ensure that UK businesses are at the forefront of international clean technology markets.
Dr. Katharina Brandmeier from the Grantham Institute of Climate Change and the Environment at Imperial College London. There is an elite and rather secretive club in Britain called the Magic Circle, whose members, appropriately enough, are magicians. It started in the 19th century. Entry is tough. You have to pass a magic exam involving complex tricks and illusions. You also have to swear an oath never to reveal Magic Circle secrets. And until 1991, and this really is stunning to relate, you also had to be a man. One woman did manage to trick her way in before that. She dressed as a man and called herself Raymond Lloyd. And when the rules changed just over 30 years ago to allow women in, this magician revealed her actual female identity and was then promptly thrown out for deliberate deception. The woman seemingly then vanished as if into thin air and hasn't been seen since. Well, now we have the news that the first female chair of the Magic Circle is trying to find her. My colleague Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to her. She's Laura London.
Well, it's quite an extraordinary story. It seems that this wasn't just a one-person job, though. This was a two-man job, should I say, or two-woman job, in actual fact. A woman called Jenny Winstanley was a magician who was working in the seaside resorts around Great Yarmouth, and I suspect desperately wanted to be a member of the most prestigious magic society in the world, the Magic Circle, but couldn't get in. So she came up with this idea that she would train up an actress friend of hers called Sophie Lloyd, and they would sort of dupe the Magic Circle into believing that Sophie was indeed a man called Raymond Lloyd, and Raymond would have to go in and do an exam in front of magicians. So not only did she get away with it by convincing these men that she was indeed male, she also was very good because she passed. And this wasn't just something they came up with on a whim. It was about an 18-month orchestrated deception, a heist as it was. And I love that they did it. It was almost to prove that the women were just as good as the men.
Now, she did come clean in 1991 when women were allowed to be admitted. And it was almost like the big reveal behind the curtain. She threw off the disguise and said, ta-da, I've been female all along. And they kicked her out anyway. Then she disappears as if by magic. Where is she now? Do we know?
Well, first of all, I mean, that's the saddest thing about it. The saddest thing, I'm sure that both Sophie and Jenny thought that the Magic Circle find it incredibly funny, you know, being entertainers and all, and of course, keep her in the society. And then hopefully Jenny would have joined as well, and it would have been lovely. I'm sure that was what was expected, but that didn't happen. We don't hear much about her until 1997, where there's an article in a newspaper, should I say, in Leamington Spa, where she was doing educational shows. It was called the Wellhard Show, and it was an anti-bullying campaign, and she was using magic in that. That was then sort of when the trail goes, it goes cold from then. Nobody's sort of heard of her since. We have had a little update though. Since today, it is quite possible that Sophie Lloyd was actually her acting name, and her real name might have been Sue or Susan.
You've now become the first female chair of the Magic Circle, and you want to, what, make amends, welcome her back? And why is this important to you?
This story, we want to share it. We want to bring her back. That would be the first thing. To invite her back to the society would be absolutely amazing. I personally would like to thank her for doing this, because I think it was a brave, brave thing to do, and her point was proven so brilliantly well. And I guess, you know, the least we can do is apologise.
Quite right too. Laura London, current chair of the Magic Circle, speaking to Rebecca Kesby. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. A doctor in Moscow who was accused of criticising the Russian army by the mother of a child she was treating has been sentenced to 5.5 years in a penal colony. Nadezhda Biyanova joins more than 1,000 other people who've been prosecuted for making comments about the Ukraine war. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was in court.
At a Moscow courthouse, a 68-year-old paediatrician is led into a courtroom and locked inside a glass and metal cage. As she awaits the verdict in her trial, Nadezhda Buyanova tells me through the glass what she thinks of the case against her. It's absurd, she says. I can't get my head around what is happening to me. Perhaps at some point I will. Minutes later, a judge finds her guilty of spreading false information about the Russian armed forces and sentences her to 5.5 years in a penal colony. The doctor had been reported to police by the mother of a 7-year-old boy she'd been treating. The woman claimed that the doctor had made negative comments about the boy's father, a Russian soldier who'd been killed fighting in Ukraine, and that she'd said Russian servicemen there were legitimate targets. Nadezhda Buyanova, who was born in Ukraine but later became a Russian citizen, denies saying that. Her lawyer, Oskar Chergiev, describes the sentence as monstrously harsh. Even given what's happening in Russia today, he says, we didn't expect this. And yet, last month, a Moscow nurse, Olga Mienshik, was sentenced to 8 years in prison on the same charge. That was for 2 anti-war posts on social media. Back in the courthouse, I speak to Alina, one of a group of people who'd come to show their support for Nadezhda Buyanova. For me, Alina says, it was important that Nadezhda saw a lot of us had come to support her, that even if a miracle didn't happen, and we all still hoped it would at least be a little bit easier for her. The law against spreading false information about the army is one of a number of harsh pieces of legislation adopted here since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, with the aim of silencing or punishing criticism of the war. Nadezhda Buyanova's trial is the latest sign that for Russia, a war abroad is fueling repression at home.
And that was Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, reporting some news very briefly to give you. It's broken in the last couple of seconds that Samantha Harvey has won the Booker Prize for Literature with her fantastic book, Orbital. Now, one of the greatest paintings in the world is just beginning a transformation which eventually should throw a whole new light on it. In fact, literally, when it comes to Rembrandt's immense canvas, The Night Watch, hanging in pride of place in the Gallery of Honour at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, because it's thought that the astonishingly vivid portrayal of a group of guardsmen may have become dulled over the centuries. Now, after 5 years of painstaking research, a huge restoration of the painting has got underway today. Taco Dibitz is the director of the Rijksmuseum.
The Night Watch depicts a group of around 36 men who had themselves portrayed. They were the ones during wartime who protected the cities. And Rembrandt revolutionized the way we look at people and we depict people. His way of painting is very direct and very intense. And in a sense, he shows the bare truth. He doesn't paint people more beautiful than they are, more ugly than they are now. He just paints us all as we are. And that's where his strength lies.
I have to confess that when my editor today said we'd like to do something about the start of the restoration of the Night Watch, I said to her, oh, but I thought that it had started, because when I was at the Rijksmuseum in July, it seemed to be that the process was underway. Can you explain to me why I'm wrong and in a sense what you have been up to over the last few years?
Over the past 5 years, we've been making an in-depth study of the Night Watch. It's a large painting, over 4 meters, and we've, in a way, mapped out the whole painting, as you would do with a geographical map of a landscape. We researched all the layers of paint that were applied on it by Rembrandt, but also by later restorers, the varnish layers, and we looked at it to find out more about how Rembrandt worked. And actually what we discovered, that Rembrandt made an underdrawing for this huge composition, which is also very complex. So we never understood how could he do it without any kind of guide to himself. And he made this underdrawing. That was one of the things that we discovered. And we also found ways in how to best preserve it. And now the first step in the actual conservation is the taking off of the varnish, which is mainly 20th century varnish, but also older varnishes, which were applied before that without touching, of course, the paint that Rembrandt actually painted.
And am I right in saying that that varnish has, over time, darkened the original picture?
That's the result of the yellowing of the varnish, of dirt layers that come out on the top. The varnish, it also becomes less transparent, so you could really see less of the painting. And obviously, right, we want to show it to the public in the optimal way. And by taking off the varnish and also by restoring it meticulously and filling in the missing paint, you will get much more depth into the painting with the contrast of light and dark stronger. And something else is that the Night Watch had a very checkered past. It was painted for, you could say, the clubhouse of these men who had themselves portrayed, where there was a lot of smoking, drinking, etc. And then during the centuries, it was always famous. It was restored quite often, not in the most friendly way. And then in the 1970s, it was attacked by a knife. And when that happened, in 4 months, they restored the entire painting. But they really did it very fast. And you see it, that they weren't too precise always. They wanted it to be back to normal, in a sense. So that's, I think, why it happened so fast at that time. And now we can do it with much more precision using microscopes, etc. We will be able to show it in a way that you could have never seen it before.
But the wonderful thing is that people will still be able to see the painting, and they will be able to see the restoration process in progress.
Yeah, in a sense, you will be step by step, you will be able to see the life of the painting, including the attack. Everything you will see bare, so you will see the nude painting as it is, and we'll get, in that sense, really close to Rembrandt and to the life of the Night Watch. So it's quite a unique experience to get a glimpse in the lab of the conservators, in the room itself, in the galleries. You see them at work.
Taco Dibbets, Director of the Rijksmuseum, from all of us on NewsHour. Thanks for listening.